Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and I'm so excited about today's show. Firstly, let's admit to some guilty pleasures. Some of us, okay, all of us, are totally devoted to one TV series, or two, or more. A few weeks back, for example, the buzz was all about Breaking Bad. And of course, most of us are counting down the days till we're back with our favorite lords and ladies at Downton Abbey. Though I'm still so sad for Lady Mary and the fatherless new baby. Yes, we all subscribe to appointment viewing, but many of us also can't wait for the next installment of our favorite literary characters, like Kinsey Millhone, Kay Scarpetta, Harry Bosch, Ma Ramotswe, Stephanie Plum, Jack Reacher, and so many more. So let's check in with some of our favorites and meet some new characters too. Adventure, romance, thrillers, and more. What fun! As we turn to page one of the book report. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. Happen when Sue Grafton runs out of letters. The world of thrillers will be a sadder place. But we've still got some of the alphabet left, so we'll begin today's book report with the new one, Book 23 in the Alphabet series by Sue Grafton. W is for Wasted. Two dead bodies changed the course of Kinsey Millhone's life. One of them, Kinsey knew, and the other she'd never laid eyes on until she saw him in the morgue. The first was a local PI of suspect reputation. He'd been gunned down near the beach at Santa Teresa. The other corpse was found on the beach 6 weeks later. He had no ID, but a slip of paper with Millhone's name and number was found in his pockets. Two seemingly unrelated deaths, but as Kinsey digs into the mystery of the John Doe, strange linkages with far-reaching ramifications begin to emerge. Judy Kay narrates.
The story about the second dead man is more complex and takes longer to articulate, especially since the facts emerged slowly over a matter of weeks. The coroner's office called me on a Friday afternoon, asking if I could ID a John Doe who had my name and phone number on a slip of paper in his pocket. How could I resist? Every good mystery takes place on three planes: what really happened, what appears to have happened, and how the sleuth, amateur or professional, yours truly in this case, figures out which is which. I suppose I could put everything in perspective if I explained how it all turned out and then doubled back to that phone call. But it's better if you experience it just as I did, one strange step at a time. This was October 7th, 1988, and it looked like things were as bad as they were going to get. On the national front, congressional spending was a whopping $1,064.14 billion, and the federal debt was topping out at $2,601.3 billion. Unemployment hovered at 5.5%, and the price of a first-class postage stamp had jumped from 22 cents to 25. I tend to disregard issues over which I have no control. Like it or not, the politicians don't consult me about economic policies, budget cuts, or the gross national product, whatever that is. I might voice an opinion, if I had one, but as nearly as I can tell, nobody pays the slightest attention, so what's the point? My only hope is to be the master of my own small universe, which is centered in a Southern California town 96 miles north of Los Angeles. My name is Kinsey Millhone. I'm a private investigator, female, age 38. I rent office space in a two-room bungalow with a kitchenette and a bathroom on a narrow side street in the heart of Santa Teresa, population 85,810, minus the two dead guys. Since I'm the sole proprietor and lone employee, I operate on a modest scale, supporting myself by doing missing person searches, background checks, witness location, and the occasional service of process. From time to time, I'm hired to establish paper trails in legal, financial, or property disputes. On a more personal note, let me say that I believe in law and order, loyalty, and patriotism, old-fashioned values that might seem woefully out of date. I also believe in earning an honest living so I can pay my taxes, cover my monthly bills, and tuck any surplus into my retirement account. When I reached the coroner's office, I was ushered into a bay with the curtain discreetly pulled around the ceiling track. Though curious, I wasn't apprehensive. I'd done a quick survey and could account for the people I knew and loved. There were those who orbited my world in a wider gyre, but I couldn't think of one whose death would have had a significant impact. The dead man was stretched out on a gurney with a sheet pulled up to his chin, so there was nothing of an intimate nature in evidence. He was not someone I recognized. His skin tones were gray, underlined with a pale gold that suggested liver issues of a profound and possibly fatal nature. His features had been softened and flattened in death, angles worn as smooth as stone over which water has poured for thousands of years. The human spirit does more than animate the face. It lends character and definition. Here, there was none. The decedent, to use the official term, appeared to be in his early 70s, white and overweight in the manner of those who forego their 9 servings of fresh fruits and vegetables per day. Judging by the bulbous nose and broken veins across his weather-darkened face, he'd enjoyed alcohol in sufficient quantities to pickle the average adult. Sometimes the dead seemed to sleep. This man did not. I studied him at length, and there was not even the faintest suggestion that he was breathing. Whatever spell had been cast over him, the effects were permanent.
We've just heard W is for Wasted by Sue Grafton. Debbie Maycomber is one of today's most popular writers, with more than 170 million copies of her books in print worldwide. She's written more than 100 novels, 2 best-selling cookbooks, 2 acclaimed children's books, and the Mrs. Miracle Christmas novels. Her Cedar Cove series is the basis for a Hallmark Channel series. The recipient of many awards, in 2010, the Romance Writers of America presented Debbie with their prestigious Nora Roberts Lifetime Achievement Award. In addition to her best-selling novels, Debbie owns her own tea room and a yarn store. Debbie and her husband live in Port Orchard, Washington State, the town on which her Cedar Cove novels are based. Today, we'll speak with Debbie about her new novel, Rose Harbor in Bloom. Welcome, Debbie. It's great to have you with us on the Book Report. You're such a prolific writer. What got you started?
I am a born storyteller. I grew up making up stories. Every night when I would go to sleep, I would be making up stories. The only way I can think to describe how I felt about being a writer is if you burn yourself, it can throb with pain. But every time I thought about being a writer, I throbbed with joy. And that throbbing joy, that happy anticipation, just followed me all the way to adulthood. And one time I just decided, I really want to do this. I want to write books. And so I started off, and it was just that decision to be a writer, to do what I loved.
Well, we're all very, very lucky for that. Tell us about Jo Marie, the central character in Rose Harbor in Bloom.
Jo Marie is a war widow. Her husband was killed in Afghanistan. And as part of the healing process, she buys a bed and breakfast that is in Cedar Cove, Washington. And the people that come and stay at the inn are also in need of healing and hope and renewal. And it's all a process that they help one another through this. It's stories that are relevant and provocative, and that's really my goal as a writer, is to create stories that the readers are going to say, that could be me, or that has already happened to somebody I know, because they're realistic and creative and told in a way that makes them identify with the characters.
Now, you live in Port Orchard, a town very much like Cedar Cove. Are some of your characters based on people you've met there?
Actually, yes and no. How I create the characters is I come up first with the premise of the plot idea, and then I create the character to go along with that premise. And sometimes I'll be inspired by something from somebody I know, but I don't ever really base characters on, you know, totally on one person. The character of Charlotte is loosely based on my own mother and a woman in town, a wonderful knitter by the name of Laura Early. So, I mean, that's about as close as it gets.
All right. Your bio says you read 700 fan emails a day. Do your readers suggest storylines?
I've had as many as 700 a day. And yes, they have. I have actually used some of their ideas. Last Christmas, I had a book out called Angels at the Table, and there was an angel in there by the name of Will, and he was suggested by a reader who said, I got the idea from the verse in the 23rd Psalm, surely goodness and mercy will follow you. And she said, you need an apprentice angel named Will. Well, after she said, you need an angel named Will, I made him an apprentice.
All right. What's it like having a TV series based on your work?
Oh, Elaine, that is so fun to have this TV series with Annie McDowell is magical, above and beyond anything I could have even thought or imagined.
You actually own a yarn store and a tea shop. Are you going to open a bed and breakfast next?
You know, it's I've toyed with the thought. I really have. There's a wonderful bed and breakfast. I've used the building as the basis for the Rose Harbor Inn series. And, you know, I wouldn't mind doing that. Can you imagine? I ride above a yarn store. Is this heaven or what?
You know, one thing that really touched me in the book, Jo Marie's soldier husband is lost in Afghanistan, but yet she feels his presence and gets strength from him. Has that happened to you?
Well, just recently, our daughter was married, and she was married on outside on a beautiful summer day on the beach, and there were two eagles that flew over as they were as Jody and Greg were exchanging their vows. My maiden name is the German word for eagle, and I think that was my mom and dad that just came to stop by to visit. And so, you know, there are moments like that in life, and I think that I just kind of incorporate that with Jo Marie.
Yeah.
There are moments in life when we feel close to those.
I feel that too. So what's next for you?
Oh, there's so many things going on that are so exciting. I'm very excited about the Rose Harbor Inn series, the new book that's coming out in October, or my Christmas book that I do every year. We're talking about a new Christmas movie. So there are just wonderful things going on. My husband and I are going to Scotland and Iceland in a couple of weeks, and it's just I feel it's a good place in our life.
That's great. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Elaine. It was a pleasure.
All righty. Bye.
Bye-bye.
And now let's listen to a sampling of Rose Harbor in Bloom, book two in the Cedar Cove series, narrated by Lorelei King.
Mark was an interesting character. I'd given him plenty of work, but I had yet to figure out if he considered me a friend. He acted like my friend most of the time, but then every so often he turned into a grumpy, unlikable, cantankerous, unreasonable. The list went on. "What's up?" I called out.
"Nothing," he barked back.
Apparently the ill-tempered monster had returned. Months ago I'd asked Mark to dig up a large portion of the yard for a rose garden. He told me this project would be low on his priority list. He seemed to work on it when the mood struck him, which unfortunately wasn't often, but still I thought a month or two would be adequate in between the other projects he'd done for me. To be fair to Mark, though, it had been a harsh winter. Still, my expectations hadn't been met. I'd wanted the rose bushes planted by now. I'd so hoped to have the garden in full bloom in time for the open house I planned to host for the Cedar Cove Chamber of Commerce. The problem, or at least one of them, was the fact that Mark was a perfectionist. He must have taken a week simply to measure the yard. String and chalk markings crisscrossed from one end of the freshly mowed lawn to the other. Yes, Mark had insisted on mowing it first, before he measured. Normally, I'm not this impatient, but enough was enough. Mark was a skilled handyman. I had yet to find anything he couldn't do. He was an all-purpose kind of guy, and most of the time I felt lucky to have him around. It seemed as time progressed, I found more and more small jobs that required his attention. New to this business and not so handy myself, I needed someone I could rely on to make minor repairs. As a result, the plans for the rose garden had basically been ignored until the very last minute. At the rate Mark worked, I'd resigned myself to the fact that it wasn't possible for it to be ready before Sunday afternoon. I watched as he straightened and wiped his forearm across his brow. Looking up, he seemed to notice I was still watching him from the porch.
"You gonna complain again?" he demanded.
I didn't say a word. Reading his mood, I forced myself to bite my tongue before I said something to set him off. All Mark needed was one derogatory word from me as an excuse to leave for the day.
"You didn't need to say anything," Mark grumbled. "I can read frowns, too."
Rover raised his head at Mark's less than happy tone, and then looked back at me as though he expected me to return the verbal volley. I couldn't help being disappointed, and it would have been easy to follow through with a few well-chosen words. Instead, I smiled ever so sweetly, determined to hold my tongue. All I could say was that it was a good thing Mark charged by the job and not by the hour.
"Just say what's on your mind," he insisted.
"I thought I told you I wanted the rose garden planted before I held the open house," I said, doing my level best not to show my frustration.
"You might have mentioned this earlier, then," he snapped.
"I did."
"Clearly it slipped my mind."
"Well, don't get your dander up." It wasn't worth fighting about at this late date. The invitations were mailed, and the event, ready or not, was scheduled for this very weekend. It would be nothing short of a miracle if Mark finished before then. No need to get upset about it now. Actually, I was as much at fault for this delay as Mark. Often before he ever started work, I'd invite him in for coffee. I discovered that he was as interesting as he was prickly. Perhaps most surprising of all was that he'd become one of my closest friends in Cedar Cove, so naturally I wanted to find out what I could about him. The problem was, he wasn't much of a talker. I'd learn more about him while playing Scrabble than in conversation. He was smart and competitive, and he had a huge vocabulary. Even now, after 5 months, he avoided questions and never talked about anything personal. I didn't know if he'd ever been married or if he had family in the area. Despite all our conversations, most of what I knew about him I'd deduced on my own. He lived alone. He didn't like talking on the phone, and he had a sweet tooth. He tended to be a perfectionist, and he took his own sweet time on a project. That was the sum total of everything I'd learned about a man I saw on average 4 or 5 times a week.
That was Rose Harbor in Bloom by Debbie Maycomber. In Linda Miller's Big Sky Wedding, book 5 in the Parable Montana series, wedding bells are ringing. But Briley Parrish hasn't enjoyed that sound since she was jilted at the altar. Briley's put that part of her life behind her. She's moved on, concentrating on building a multi-million dollar business. But when A-list actor Zane Sutton comes home to his rodeo roots, Briley's well-ordered world turns into one wild ride. Jack Garrett narrates.
He'd simply realized he was damn good and fed up with the status quo. Glamorous though it was. Acting in movies was all right, mostly easy work, if deadly boring a lot of the time. But lately it had been getting harder and harder to tell the difference between playing a part and the real deal. The offshoot of all this sudden clarity was that Zane had found himself on a car lot in L.A., trading in his supercharged European ride for a shiny silver pickup truck with an extended cab. In a spate of nonverbal ad-libbing, he'd driven the new truck to the nearest animal shelter, gone inside, and adopted a dog, an unprepossessing critter, big and black with floppy ears. He dubbed the animal Slim, mainly because its ribs showed, a consequence of missing a few meals along the way. Leaving pretty much everything else he owned behind, Zane, with Slim, had headed north by northeast, stopping only to grab a couple of drive-through burgers here and there, gas up the truck, and snooze a little in rest-stop parking lots. They'd reached Hangman's Bend late the previous night, camping out in the unfurnished ranch house. That morning, Slim had taken a liking to a certain shady spot on the porch, so he'd stayed behind when Zane set out to get a good look at the wooded section of his land. He was on foot because his horse, Blackjack, was still in transit from the California stables where he'd been boarding the gelding since his move to L.A. several years earlier. He followed the meandering creek for a bit, enjoying the way it stitched its path through the woods like a wide strand of silver thread, clear and sun-sparkled and almost musical as it rolled over worn stones that resembled jewels under the water, coursed around primordial boulders and tree stumps, some of them petrified, on its way to wherever it was going. Zane made a mental note to check a map later when he got back to the house, because he liked knowing the facts about things, like knowing exactly where he was, both literally and figuratively. But at the moment, he was in no great hurry to turn homeward. He was out to find the southern corner of his property, supposedly staked out and flagged. At least 8 feet wide, probably 10 or 12 in some places, the stream would be difficult to cross. But eventually he came to a natural bridge, a line of 6 flat stones, small and fairly far apart. Still fit, even after living fancy from the day he'd signed that first film contract till he left Hollywood behind him. He figured he could make it to the other side without getting his boots wet, let alone taking a header into that glacier-chilled creek water. With his arms outstretched for balance, the way he and Landry used to do when they walked the top rail of a fence as kids, he moved with relative ease, never setting both feet down on the same rock, since there wasn't room. When he reached the opposite bank, no longer concentrating so hard, he stopped short, startled by what amounted to a vision. A wood nymph, dressed in faded blue jeans, battered boots, and a pale green western shirt, stood in the center of the small clearing just ahead, both arms wrapped around the trunk of a lone cottonwood tree. Her hair was brown and shiny and thick, just brushing her shoulders, and it caught the leaf-filtered light, threw it around like colored beams in a prism. Her head was tilted back slightly, her eyes closed, and the expression on her fine-boned face was downright blissful. Zane could have watched her for hours. Just looking at the woman gave him the same belly-clenching thrill he'd gotten in his bronc-riding days, in that moment before the chute gate swung open and the official 8-second countdown began. But suddenly off his game, he took an unintended half-step in her direction. A twig snapped under the sole of his boot, and the moment was over. The nymph's eyes were wide, hazel or maybe green or pale gray, and at the moment, seeing him, they were shooting fire.
We've just heard Big Sky Wedding by Linda Miller. Thankless in Death is book 37 of J.D. Robb's In Death series. Book 37, wow! And when you consider that J.D. Robb is just one of the pen names for Nora Roberts, it's absolutely astounding to contemplate this writer's body of work. In this popular title, the year 2060 is drawing to a close. Thanksgiving is just around the corner. It's a time for loved ones to come together. But sometimes the deepest hatred seethes within the closest relationships, and blood flows faster than water. For Lieutenant Eve Dallas of the NYPSD, the job is a reminder of what she has to be grateful for. Hosting Rourke's big Irish family for the holiday may be challenging, but it's a joyful improvement on her dark childhood. But Eve's job takes her away from her happy holiday into a dark, horrible murder. The Reinholds have been found stabbed and bludgeoned. Those who knew them are stunned and even more heartbroken by the overwhelming evidence they were murdered by their own son. Turns out 26-year-old Jerry is not only capable of brutality, he seems to have taken a liking to it. With the money he's stolen from his parents and a long list of grievances, he intends to finally make his mark on the world. Eve and her team race to discover where Jerry's going to strike next. Susan Erickson performs the book.
You've gone through 4 jobs this year. What options are you considering while you're sitting here in the middle of the day in the ratty sweats you slept in? I told you, they're looking for a stock boy down at the market, but do you go and see about it? I'm not a freaking stock boy. He was better than that. He was somebody. He'd be somebody if people gave him half a break. Get off my back! Maybe we haven't been on your back enough. She layered a slice of bright orange cheese on top of the turkey, and her voice took on the soft, reasonable tone he hated. Your father and I scrimped and saved so you could go to college. And you flunked out. You said how you wanted to train so you could learn how to develop those computer games you like so much. And we backed you on that, put the money to that. When that didn't work, your dad got you a job at his office. He went to bat for you, Jerry. And you screwed around and mouthed off and got fired. She picked a knife from the block to cut the sandwich. Then you met Lori, and she was the sweetest thing. A smart girl, a hard-working girl from a real nice family. We had such high hopes there. She got you working as a busboy in the restaurant where she works, and she stuck with you when you lost that job. When you said how you could get a messenger job if you had a good bike, we made you a loan, but that didn't last 2 months, and you never paid us back, Jerry. Now this last job's gone, too. I'm tired of you throwing the past in my face and acting like it was all my fault. The past keeps repeating, Jerry, and seems to be getting worse. Her lips pressed together as she added a handful of the onion doodles he liked to the plate. You're out of work again, and you can't afford a place of your own. You took the rent money and the tip money Lori had saved up and went off to Las Vegas with Dave and that no-account Joe, and you came back broke. That's a damn lie, he shoved to his feet. It was my money, and I've got a right to take a break with my friends, to have some fun. There was a sheen in her eyes, not of tears, not of anger, but of disappointment. It made him want to punch that sheen away. It was the rent money, Jerry, and the money Lori saved up from her tips, she told me. You're going to take her word over mine? On a sigh, she folded a napkin into a triangle as she had for him when he was a boy. Her dented heart came clearly through the sound, but all he heard was accusation. You lie, Jerry, and you use people, and I'm worried we let you get away with it for too long. We keep giving you chances, and you keep throwing them away. Maybe some of that's our fault, and maybe that's part of the reason you think you can talk to me the way you are. She set the plate on the table, poured a glass of the coffee-flavored drink he liked. Your father and I were hoping you'd find a job today. Or at least go out and look, make a real effort. We talked about it after you went out with your friends again last night. after you took $50 out of my emergency cash without asking. What are you talking about? He gave her his best, shocked and insulted look. I didn't take anything from you. You're saying I'm stealing now? Ma! It wouldn't be the first time.
That was Thankless in Death by J.D. Robb. Fever Dream is book 10 of Lincoln Child's and Douglas Preston's popular series. Special Agent Pendergast is putting to rest long-ignored possessions that remind him of his wife Helen's tragic death. Then, he makes a stunning and dreadful discovery. Helen had been mauled by a vicious lion while they were big game hunting in Africa. But now, Pendergast learns her rifle, her only protection from the beast, had been deliberately loaded with blanks. Who could have wanted Helen dead? And why? With Lieutenant Vincent D'Agosta's assistance, Pendergast embarks on a quest to uncover the mystery of his wife's murder. It's a journey that sends him deep into her past, where he learns much that Helen herself had wished to keep hidden. Renee Aubergenois narrates. Fans, heads up, the newest title in the series, number 13, Whitefire, will be available in audio in mid-November.
I'm not cut out for the FBI. I don't like rules. In any case, you're all over the world with that Doctors with Wings outfit. We can live anywhere as long as it's close to an international airport. Our two souls therefore endure not a breach, but an expansion, like gold to airy thinness beat. Don't bring me to Africa and quote John Donne. Kipling, maybe. Every woman knows all about everything, he intoned. On second thought, spare me the Kipling as well. What did you do as a teenager, memorize Bartlett's? Among other things. Pendergast glanced up. A figure was approaching along the trail from the west. He was a tall Nyimba tribesman, dressed in shorts and a dirty T-shirt, an ancient rifle slung over his shoulders, carrying a forked walking stick. As he approached the camp, he paused and cried out a greeting in Bemba, the local lingua franca, which was answered by welcoming shouts from the kitchen tent. He then proceeded into camp and approached the table at which the Pendergasts were seated. Both rose. Uma natu umo, uma suma aafika, Pendergast said by way of greeting, and grasped the man's dusty, warm hand, Zambian fashion. The man proffered his walking stick to Pendergast. There was a note wedged into its fork. For me? Pendergast asked, switching to English. From the district commissioner. Pendergast shot a glance at his wife, then removed the note and unfolded it. My dear Pendergast, I wish to have a conversation with you immediately via SSB. There has been a nasty business at Kingazu Camp. Very nasty. Alastair Woking, D.C., South Luanga. A P.S. Dear chap, you know perfectly well that regulations require you to have SSB communications set up at every bush camp. It is most annoying to have to send a runner like this. I don't like the sound of that, said Helen Pendergast, looking over her husband's shoulder. What do you think this nasty business is? Perhaps a photo tourist has suffered the amorous advances of a rhinoceros? That's not funny, Helen said, laughing all the same. It is rutting season, you know. Pendergast folded the note and shoved it in his breast pocket. I'm very much afraid this means our shooting safari is over. He walked over to the tent, opened a box, and began screwing together the battered pieces of an aerial antenna, which he then carried up into a musasa tree and wired to an upper branch. Climbing back down, he plugged the wire into the single sideband radio he had placed on the table, turned on the unit, adjusted the dials to the correct frequency, and sent out a call. In a moment, the irritated voice of the district commissioner came back squawking and scratchy. Pendergast, for God's sake, where are you? Upper Makwale Stream Camp. Blast! I was hoping you were nearer the Banta Road. Why the devil don't you keep your SSB connected? I've been trying to reach you for hours. May I ask what's happened? Over at Kingazu Camp, a German tourist was killed by a lion. What idiot allowed that to happen? It wasn't like that. The lion came right into camp in broad daylight, jumped the man as he was walking back to his hut from the dining tent, and dragged him screaming into the bush. And then? Surely you can imagine, and then. The wife was hysterical, the whole camp went into an uproar. They had to bring in a helicopter to airlift out the tourists. The camp staff left behind are scared shiteless. This fellow was a well-known photographer in Germany. Bloody bad for business. Did you track the lion? We have trackers and guns, but nobody who'll go into the bush after this lion. Nobody with the experience or the bollocks. That's why we need you, Pendergast. We need you down here to track that bugger and, well, recover the remains of the poor German before there's nothing left to bury.
We've just heard Fever Dream by Lincoln Child and Douglas Preston. This year, small is the next big thing. That's why the Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop is building elegant, affordable small space furniture for your little place. Itsy Bitsy Ritzy Shop furniture is handcrafted in America with a more petite footprint to make any room look larger. It's furniture that multitasks like you do, and most of it has storage built in. To see a little more, visit ibrshop.com. That's ibrshop.com, where small is beautiful. Mayan Secrets, Book 5 of Clive Cussler's Fargo Adventures, husband and wife team Sam and Remy Fargo are in Mexico when they come upon a remarkable discovery. They find the skeleton of a man clutching an ancient sealed pot, and within the pot, a Mayan book, larger than anything anyone has seen before. The book contains astonishing information about the Mayans, about their cities, and about mankind. The secrets are so powerful, some people would do anything to possess them, as the Fargos are about to find out. Scott Brick narrates.
Thousands of silvery fish swam past Sam and Remy Fargo, gleaming, turning this way and that in unison, as though they were all controlled by one mind. The water was clear and warm, and Sam and Remy could see far beyond the steel bars of their cage. Sam held a 3-foot aluminum shaft with a small, sharp barb on the end. It was a tool for the application of tags, and in the weeks since he and Remy had been on this voyage, he'd become adept at using it. He looked at her, and then ahead again, staring into the distance. As they watched, a darker spot seemed to form itself at the limit of their sight, as though the tiny particles held in the water were coming together to form a solid shape. It was a shark. And as Sam and Remy had known he would, he turned toward them. He came at an angle, drawn perhaps by the dense schools of fish that had gathered near the steel shark cage and flitted in and out between the bars. But there was no question the shark was aware of Sam and Remy. The Fargos were experienced divers, and they were both used to the idea that it was not possible to go into the ocean anywhere in the world without having a shark notice their presence. They had seen many sharks over the years, usually small blues that came close to investigate the wet-suited newcomers diving near the kelp beds not far from their home in San Diego, reject them as prey and swim off. This shark embodied the other possibility. The nightmare predator, always swimming forward to keep the water moving through its gills, equipped with sight, smell, hearing, a network of nerves running along its body that felt even small vibrations in the water, and the ability to sense minute electrical discharges from the muscle contractions of its victims. The shark's large tail gave a series of lazy undulations, and it moved toward them. As its outline became easier to see in the clear water, the shark seemed to grow. In the distance it had seemed large, but now, as it approached them, Sam realized that he had observed it much farther away. The closer it grew, it became immense. It was exactly what he and Remy had come to find, great whites that were over 20 feet long. The shark swam through a school of fish that separated into 2 swirling swarms, then reunited into a school again, but the shark paid no attention to them. Its tail gave another undulation, and it glided ahead. The shark, its nose a flattish, pointed protuberance that seemed about 4 feet wide, moved through the water toward them, then turned again. The shark's body swung past the steel cage where Sam and Remy were hanging, so close that they could have reached out and touched it. The body was thick, and the pointed dorsal fin above it looked as tall as a man. The shark didn't leave. It passed by them again. Sam and Remy remained motionless inside their cage. Even after many dives near the island, Sam found that during these long minutes, he became conscious of the steel bars that had been welded into the cage. Were they solid? They had seemed to be when the cage had been lifted into the water by the crane. The welds, he now could see, looked short and hasty, maybe unreliable. The welder couldn't possibly have imagined the size and power of the creature just now passing by. This animal was at Guadalupe Island to find elephant seals and tuna, and Sam and Remy didn't look much like either. In their black wetsuits, though, they looked a bit more like California sea lions, which could make them seem very tasty to a great white. Then, as abruptly as it had appeared, the shark gave a few twitches of its tail and glided away from the cage. For a few seconds, Sam felt intense disappointment. Considering their size and ferocity, great whites were sometimes surprisingly cautious. Had Sam missed his only chance to get this giant on record? Then, without warning, the shark wheeled about, flicked its tail 4 or 5 times, and barreled into the broad side of the steel cage, its huge mouth gaping, revealing the rows of triangular teeth. Sam and Remy clung to the bars on the opposite side of the cage while the shark shook the forward part of its body, working to get its jaws around the cage, but unable to accomplish it. As the shark pushed the cage forward, the cage tilted, and Sam saw his chance. He jabbed the aluminum shaft into the skin at the base of the tall dorsal fin and immediately withdrew it, pulling it back inside the cage.
That was The Mayan Secrets by Clive Cussler and Thomas Perry. In The Highway, C.J. Box's gripping new thriller in the Cody Hoyt series, teenagers Danielle and Gracie Sullivan take a car trip to visit big sister Danielle's boyfriend in Montana. They never arrive. The girls in their car simply vanish. Cody Hoyt, who's just lost his police job and has fallen off the wagon, is in no condition to investigate. But his partner Cassie and his son Justin, the boy Danielle and Gracie were on their way to see, convince Cody to drive south to find the girls. As Cody makes his way to the remote stretch of Montana Highway where the girls went missing, Cassie discovers there have been scores of disappearances in the state. There's a serial killer out there roaming the highways, and Cody and Cassie must find him before he takes more lives. Holter Graham performs the title. If you want to hear more from C.J. Box, we talked to him recently. To hear that interview, go to Book Report Radio, archived shows, week of April 20th, 2013.
The truck stop was 4 miles west of Billings, Montana, off I-90. A cold mist hung in the air and moisture beaded on the windows and the paint jobs of more than 70 big trucks. The black asphalt lot shined as if freshly varnished between the rows of semis, reflecting the lighted highway signs and hundreds of streams of horizontal running lights from the parked trucks themselves. The air outside hummed with rumbling engines. Tendrils of steam rose from beneath the engines and combined with the undulating waves of heated exhaust that rose from beneath the big rigs. From his high perch in the dry and warm cab, his sightlines were clear. The truck plaza itself was filled with activity, and he noted it carefully. Vehicles entered and exited the long banks of fuel pumps in front of the garish, low-slung building 100 yards away. Professional truckers filled 150-gallon aluminum tanks with diesel fuel on one side of the lot. Passenger cars and vans filled up with gasoline on the other. Inside the truck stop restaurant, waitresses served the $10.95 T-bone special advertised on the marquee near the exit. Drivers lounged in the truckers-only section, checking email, comparing road conditions, or drinking coffee. Truck stop employees cooked up fried chicken and potato wedges for the lighted bins at the front counter and manned the cash registers, selling salted snacks, energy boosters, beef jerky, and drinks. This was the way it was on the open road. Islands of lighted activity in a sea of prairie darkness. Cars and families on one side, truckers on the other, but sharing the same facility. Two vastly different worlds that met only at places like this. Inside, truck drivers and citizens barely acknowledged each other, and the modern truck stop was designed so there would be little interaction. Sure, the drivers would get on their radios and laugh at the rubes they'd run into inside and mock their looks or stupid conversations. But inside, they were segregated between the amateurs and the professionals. The clueless consumers, the civilians, the amateurs, and the cloistered universe of the providers. He was on the road so much, his outlook on it had changed completely over the years. It no longer seemed like he was moving, for one thing. Now, he felt as if he were stationary, while the road rolled under him and the scenery flowed by. The world came to him. Like the captain of a large ocean vessel, a large swath of the landscape was off limits to him, as he was confined by the shipping lanes that were interstate highways. When he parked his truck at a rest area or truck stop for the night, he couldn't venture into town, because he had no way to get there, unless he walked. It was like a captain who had to anchor his boat and take a dinghy to shore. Oh, how he resented the smug people in those towns. They thought their food, clothing, furniture, appliances, and electronics simply appeared at stores or on their front doorsteps. They didn't stop to think that every item they ate or wore or used was likely transported across the nation in the trailer of his truck or those like him. Or that the hard-working blue-collar rednecks they avoided in real life and despised on the road were the conduits of their comfort and the pipeline of their wealth. It was the Tuesday before Thanksgiving, so there was more traffic on the highways than usual. It would be much worse the next day as families moved across the country, with a lull on Thanksgiving and another spike on Sunday as people returned home. He was used to it. The rhythms of the road were like rivers that flooded and receded in perpetuity. The Beartooth Mountains to the south were light blue with new snow, and the lack of stars indicated heavy cloud cover. It was still warm enough on the valley floor that the moisture hadn't turned to snowflakes, but there was a snap in the air outside, and he watched as travelers left their cars and zipped up coats on their way into the truck stop. He snorted at an overweight family of fools wearing t-shirts and shorts who practically ran from their passenger van to the door that led to the restrooms. What if they broke down wearing clothes like that? Who would they look for to rescue them? Me, he thought. The invisible, faceless trucker.
We've just heard The Highway by C.J. Box. Child's books have been translated into 40 languages and have sold more than 60 million copies. These numbers are rather staggering when you consider Child didn't start writing until the age of 40, after being dismissed from a high-profile job in English television. Though Lee is a Brit, his character, Jack Reacher, has been described as a uniquely American hero, one part Shane, one part Philip Marlowe, and one part Rambo, if Rambo were a liberal. His military days behind him, Reacher roams the country, lingering in places just long enough to uncover wrongdoing and dispense rough justice before drifting on. His life is so stripped down, he doesn't own a change of clothes. When his shirts and pants get dirty, he throws them away and buys new ones. Today, we'll speak with Lee about his newest Reacher title, Never Go Back. Welcome, Lee. It's a thrill to have you back with us on the Book Report.
It's great to be back on. Thanks.
I want to tell listeners I was amazed at how quickly Reacher gets into some very serious trouble and Never Go Back. It's like page two, ba-boom. How do you keep on doing that?
Well, I guess he's just an unlucky guy, you know, and Never Go Back is the title of the book, but it's also advice that Reacher is normally very happy to follow. He's always about tomorrow, not yesterday. But in this instance, he's talked to the new commander of his old military unit on the phone, and she's a woman with a fascinating voice and a fascinating manner. And Reacher, being a drifter, really doesn't need much of an excuse to be anywhere, so he takes it into his head he's going to hitchhike across the country to Virginia, meet this woman, take her out to dinner. And that's exactly what he does, except that when he gets there, it's all a big disaster. She is missing, nowhere to be found. There's a strange officer at her desk who accuses Reacher of crimes that he can't remember and of associations with people he doesn't recall. It becomes very quickly a kind of nightmare, and he has to spend the rest of the book fixing the problem.
Right. I really enjoyed the bad guys in this novel. Where did your inspiration for them come from?
Well, the bad guys in this book are... I was trying to put them at a level where, you know, they were not kind of grotesque James Bond-type villains. You know, this is not Blofeld stroking his cat. I just wanted the idea of people who are trying to get away with it, but then they realize that they're going to be beaten, and they kind of take that on the chin. They sort of, they know they might lose, and yep, they're losing. And so it was a sort of a civilized approach to being a bad guy, I thought, that I was anxious to experiment with.
Hmm. When we spoke back in January, you told the story of how you came up with the name Jack Reacher. Could you share that again for listeners who may not have heard that story?
Sure. I mean, I started writing because I was out of work, and one of the issues with being out of work is that you're at home all day and therefore available for errands. And my wife said, come to the grocery with me to haul the packages home. So I did. And every time that I go into a supermarket, there's always a little old lady who says to me, you're a nice tall gentleman, would you reach me that can? So my wife said, you know what, if this writing gig doesn't work out, you could be a reacher in a supermarket. And I thought, hey, that's a good name.
Right. Now, Lee Child is your pen name. How and why did you choose that name?
You know, it was I've always worked in showbiz, and everybody always has a stage name. I've had about six, I think, in my career, so it was really... It was really not a question. And what I've been telling people recently is that I had this vision of the letters, the three letters and the five letters in the name. And I just thought I had this vision that somebody was going to write a book that would sell more than any other book in the history of the world. And you know what? It worked, but not for me, for Dan Brown.
I read in one of your interviews you'd planned to write 21 Reacher novels and then stop. Is this still the case? Never Go Back is number 18.
Well, you know, it's like that thing you say when you're a young person. You say, you know, oh, 60 sounds pretty old, and then you get close to it, and it doesn't sound so old anymore. And so that 21, I don't know. I mean, that was what I used to say, and I'm getting close to it. We'll have to see how it feels in 3 years' time. It ultimately depends on the readers. If they want more, then absolutely there will be more. If they're done with the guy by that point, then that's the end of it.
Well, talk about the Reacher creatures for a while.
Well, they are. That's what they call themselves. The Reacher creatures are the big Jack Reacher fans. And, you know, it's just a wonderful thing that if somebody had said to me at the beginning that you're going to have people that are sort of passionately interested in the character and big supporters of the character, and, you know, they rush out on the first day to buy the book and they devour the book. And then what's even more kind of touching to me is they kind of own the book. They own the character. They have created the character just as much as I have. It's my imagination and their imagination working together that make the stories. And so in a way, they do own it. You know, this is not mine anymore. This belongs to us collectively. And so it's real fascinating to me. I'll talk to readers, and their opinions are just as important as my own opinions.
Did they ever suggest characters or storylines?
Oh, all the time, you know, constantly. Every time I meet readers, I come away with great ideas. And a lot of readers say, you know, I would like to be in the book. Use my name. Make me the bad guy or something like that.
All right. Another one of your interviews, you said the way to write a thriller is to ask a question at the beginning and answer it at the end. So how do you keep coming up with these enthralling questions?
Well, it's just, you know, it's almost inevitable for a writer. It's really the other way around. If every day you have five great ideas and, you know, you go on the internet, you read the newspaper or whatever, you're going to have 5 or 10 even scenarios that you could use. It's much more a question of which one do you want to invest in, or actually which sort of 2 or 3, because I think a really good book has 2 or 3 separate ideas in it that are going to collide at some point to create the friction. And it's more a question of selecting them rather than finding them.
Hmm. Reacher is always set in America. Do you ever contemplate sending him to Afghanistan or other places?
Well, I don't make plans in the sense of, you know, I don't map out the series ahead of time, so anything is possible. But at the moment, he's content just to stick around in America, although the book that I've just started, the one for next year, who knows what's going to happen. He's been sucked into a very high-level government investigation, and it could involve foreign travel. We'll just have to see.
All right, and is there a working title for that book?
The working title is 20 Seconds Ago.
Oh.
Seems like an intriguing title to me.
I love that. So, Lee, any final thoughts?
I just want to say thanks to, you know, the people that have read and bought these books for 18 years that have made this possible. You know, they're the important ones, and every book is for them. And I just want to say thank you very much to them.
Well, I want to say thank you for keeping us enthralled and waiting for every new book. Thanks so much for joining us today, Lee.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
All righty. Bye. And now, let's listen to a sampling of Never Go Back, narrated by Dick Hill.
Reacher talked, and Turner ate. He told her the things he had been told. Red Cloud between Seoul and the DMZ, and Candace Dayton and her diary and her home in L.A., and her homelessness in L.A., and her daughter and her car, and her visit with a lawyer. Turner asked, "What's the kid's name?"
"Samantha," Reacher said. "Sam, for short, presumably."
"How old is she?"
14, nearly 15.
"How do you feel?"
"Bad. If she's mine, I should have been there for her."
"You really don't remember her mother?"
"No, I really don't."
"Is that normal for you?"
"You mean, exactly how feral am I?"
"I suppose."
"I don't think I forget people. I hope I don't, especially women I sleep with. But if I did, I would be unaware of it, by definition. You can't be aware of forgetting."
"Is this why we're going to Los Angeles?"
"I have to know," Reacher said.
"But it's suicide. They'll all be waiting for you there. It's the one place they can be sure you'll go."
"I have to know," Reacher said again. Turner said nothing. Reacher said, "Anyway, that's the story. That's what I had to tell you. In the interests of full disclosure, in case it had a bearing on the room issue, for instance." Turner didn't answer. They finished up and got their check. Reacher left a handsome tip. The car was where they had left it, unmolested, not surrounded by searchlights and SWAT teams. Far to their left, the state police barracks looked quiet. The cruisers out front had not moved.
"Stay or go?"
Turner asked. "Stay," Reacher said. "This place is as good as any. As weird as that sounds with the troopers right here, it's not going to get better than this. Not until it's over."
"Not until we win, you mean?"
"Same thing." They eased themselves into the Corvette's low seats, and Turner fired it up and drove back to the motel. She stopped outside the office.
"I'll wait here," she said. "You go do it."
"Okay," he said. He took a fistful of 20s from one of Billy Bob's bricks.
2 rooms,
she said.
That was Never Go Back by Lee Child. Readers, there are scores of big titles coming out this fall. Make sure you are up to date by checking my website, bookreportradio.com, and keep tuning in. Thanks so much for joining me today. See you back here next week on The Book Report.